Okay, take one, side two, go ahead.
Was your work in the group affected at all by the advent of missiles, ICBM? Was there any specifically related talk?
No, nothing. Okay. Nothing. But after this informal group of people from various organizations, and none of them, incidentally, were from my group, was active for a little while, they had managed to fly a very few experiments on very small 3-inch rockets, Deacon Era rockets, which Sandia Corporation, a colleague organization of ours.
Sandia. Now, these were Deacon, what kind of Deacons?
Deacon Arrow.
Deacon Arrows, okay.
Okay, they're 3-inch systems. There was a decision made, and I'm not sure how it was made, but there was a decision made at Los Alamos to form a space physics group, and these people who had been already interested in space physics were to be in that group. And it turns out, I didn't know it at the time, but there had been a feeling that maybe the Cockcroft-Walton group wasn't really that important anymore, doing the kind of work that I guess we were doing at least part of the time. At any rate, the decision was to change P4 from a Cockcroft-Walton group to a space physics group. So the people who had been doing space work were brought into the group. The group members were given a choice. Do you want to get into this new field, or do you want to get out of the group, in a sense, trading with the other people? And it was about half and half. I chose to go into the new activity, space physics, then.
Was this 1959, 60?
This was late. This was, in fact, in December of 1959.
December 59. Okay.
December of 59. And Jim Kuhn was going to be the group leader of this group.
Why did you stay? Or, stay with the space group? What was in your mind at the time? Can you recall?
It was just a new activity. As you said, things had been pretty much the same then for a few years, and it was a new and really exciting activity, and I was infected with the excitement, I guess, like the other people, and here was an opportunity to make a change essentially painlessly. I remember having to give up a couple of projects that I had embarked on in the nuclear physics area and thinking about that briefly and deciding that it was worth it.
And they shut down the Cockcroft-Walton?
They shut down the Cockcroft-Walton and gave it to the University of Kansas.
Had you had any pressures to publish up until this point?
No, not really. We weren't under any particular pressure to publish, and I had not published very much.
And most of your work went into internal Los Alamos.
I'm sorry?
Most of your work went into LASL documents.
There were some LASL documents, too, yes.
Did this attitude about publishing change when you got into the space group?
No, I don't think the attitude about publishing changed. There was so much technology to swallow then and to learn how to do that was the issue for quite some time. I think it was realized right away that a space group without a mission, a program, was not going to be very viable. And so part of the decision to make a space group was a bootstrapping operation. It was to give us the wherewithal to go after a project, a mission of some sort.
And who did you look to?
And there was discussions at that time about the Vela satellite, what became the Vela satellite program. In other words, verification, test band monitoring. That was
discussions in the Air Force, discussions in AEC?
Discussions amongst everyone who was concerned, certainly included the Air Force. We were discussing it very strongly at Los Alamos and trying to carve out a role for ourselves.
This is after the nuclear test ban treaty.
No, it wasn't. Before. This was leading up to the nuclear test ban treaty. The discussions, including discussions with the Russians, had started in like 57 or 58 about a test ban treaty.
Right.
And a committee.
The AEC had responsibility by the Eisenhower administration.
Yes, before. And AEC was a major player because the AEC presumably knew how to make weapons and therefore how to detect weapons, and detection was a big issue. I forgot what I was going to say, but at any rate, that was the mission we went after just as soon as the group was formed. I know what I was going to say. There had been a group of high-level people chaired by Panofsky who wrote a report, I think, in 59. I'm not sure what the date was. It was before our group was formed, in fact. laying out the issues and monitoring test ban treaty. And our administrative people, this is Richard Taschek, who was like the...
How do you spell
Taschek? T-A-S-C-H-E-K.
C-H-E-K.
Yeah, Taschek. Richard Taschek was deputy division leader of the physics division at that time, and a pretty good politician, and he went hunting for that, and he was able to bring it back.
Uh-huh. Had you read anything recognizable at that time about cosmic ray physics or anything of that sort that dealt with its doing it on rockets, balloons in space? Have you read any? Had you read anything by that time of Van Allen's work or of others? Is this what you wanted to do in the space physics group?
Yes, we thought that would be a great thing to do, and in fact, the very first instruments that were flown were little particle spectrometers to make measurements of the particles that now we knew were there.
Those were on the little Deacons.
Little Deacon arrows. Yes, we had DEDX and E counter systems for charged particles, mm-hmm. so that we could sort out electrons and protons and measure something about their energy spectrum.
So you were doing this while discussions were ongoing about Vela.
Vela. We also flew detectors that were like some of the Vela detectors, X-ray and neutron counters too, because those would be part of a Vela system, and so when we had a chance, we would fly those. Now, these were not on the Deacon arrows. These came along like in 1961 on Atlas pods.
Ah, very interesting. What was the energy range, and what were you looking for?
In some cases, especially with the neutron counter, we really weren't very sure what we were going to be seeing or looking for. There was a considerable interest in trying to fly detectors that might be prototype detectors for a test ban treaty. It was not purely a looking for scientific purposes only or for just natural backgrounds.
Were you looking for solar sources or strictly non-solar sources?
We imagine that, I remember thinking that surely the solar source has got to be stronger than anything else, and we better find out all about that. And I'm really not sure quite the genesis of this, except I very early on glommed onto the area of the X-rays as being the area in the Vela program that I wanted to be concerned with. Now, this X-ray detection of the X-rays from a nuclear explosion for monitoring purposes, and that led to a concern for what the natural background of X-rays were. And at first, I just thought in terms of almost entirely the sun being the major background for that.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested because of the history of the detection of non-solar X-rays, of course, occurs in 1962 with a series of flights by the APL and NRO groups.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to 62, had you had any contact with Giacconi or Friedman or any of
the opponents? No, I had not had any contact whatever, and I don't believe any of our group had.
Uh-huh. You did have, though, technical background information on what were the particle and radiation characteristics of nuclear explosions, and so you knew.
We had theoretical predictions and enough modeling of real explosions in the atmosphere, and in a few cases where vacuum pipes had been hooked up to a nuclear explosion. So we had some data on that, yes. We knew that the case of the bomb in space would be hot enough to emit thermal radiation in the X-ray range. And in fact, the modeling of an explosion in the atmosphere had shown that that's the way most of the energy gets out, is by means of emission of X-rays. So we knew that much. We had a pretty good idea of the neutron and gamma ray radiation from a nuclear explosion, because that travels a significant distance, even in air, and measurements in air could be folded back into the original source through the intervening air. Knowledge of that was pretty well.
Did you take part, I'm not too sure about the years here, they may not be right, but Argus experiments?
No, I did not, and I don't.
That was too early.
Right, I did not.
What about Starfish?
Yes, an interesting part of this is that just as the Vela program finally got formally approved, there was this decision to go have another atmospheric and high altitude test series, and all but one of us got pulled off of Vela right at the beginning of Vela and put on this other project. And so we did go out to the 1962 high altitude test series, and we made measurements of the high altitude tests and X-rays, gamma rays, and neutrons.
Who was the one person? Why wasn't that person called off?
That was John Northrop, and he wanted to stay associated with the Vela program.
Mind the store.
Sorry?
Mind the store.
Mind the store, so to speak, yes.
But did he have anything against Starfish?
I don't believe he had anything against it. I think, in fact, he probably saw it as an opportunity to become the leader in that area then, and it didn't quite work out that way, because when we all got back home, including Jim Kuhn, our group leader, he remained group leader.
Kuhn did?
Yeah, Jim Kuhn did, yes.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But I think that there was some chance that that might have been different, and I think Northrop perceived that at the time.
I see. Well, we've pretty much identified the origin of your group.
Yes.
I think there's a lot to expand on
in
this discussion, but I'd like to know now, about what time did you start reading, let's say, journals that would contain the X-ray activities of other space groups, like you know, journals like the APJ or Nature, that sort of thing?
Let me waffle around that just a little bit, okay, by saying that from 1962, late in 62, when we got back from this test operation, we had an approved Vela program. We were simply head over heels involved in designing and building instrumentation then for that. And so for the next 2 or 3 years, we were in that status. In fact, to the point that even after we had had the first launch, and we were in the same situation with regard to the second launch, and didn't get around to publishing any of the data, or at least very, very little of it, we got a fair amount of criticism from the scientific community. And I can remember at an American Astronomical Society meeting in Seattle, a session was arranged to put a lot of pressure on us to come forth with some results. And, of course, we did that in 1964. And many people thought we would have a lot more data than we really had. But because the early instruments were like we thought programmatic detection instruments should be, that is, nuclear explosion detection instruments. They weren't scientific instruments. The very first Vela had no explicitly scientific instrument on board. It was what came out of the other instruments that we were able to use. And then that was able to be changed as time went by. And we saw right away, I can remember being at the Satellite Tracking Center in Sunnyvale for the very first Vela launch, and the X-ray detectors, which I had been PI for, started showing varying current readings. And Vetti, in fact, was there too at the time. Jim Vetti. You know Jim Vetti? He's the archivist for National Data Center or something. NASA, National Data Center.
At Goddard,
yeah.
Okay, that's a man we should learn more about.
Yeah. Oh, really? I was amazed that you don't know him. He was in on the early stages of Vela from a different perspective. It might be pretty interesting to you if you're building a story about Vela to talk to him.
I think a good thing to do then for the last minute or two is to identify some of the major names. Does that sound right to you?
Okay.
Some of the people you feel we should talk to, some of the trends, the changes in the structure of the group possibly from then till now that we should talk about. What are the milestones that we should cover in detail with you and with other people?
Well, as far as people are concerned, Jim Vetti was an interesting guy.
The ETTE.
Okay. Fred Seward was at Livermore. There was a John Noggle, which you might never have heard of, at NASA, on a steering group with people at Los Alamos, Sandia, the Air Force, and so forth. Incidentally, the sponsoring organization for that program was ARPA at the time, since become DARPA, and they furnished the money. And what was now Air Force Space Division was the leading agency to get the thing done. Some of the other people, there was,
you can fill them in.
I can fill them in, so sure. Perhaps we should play it that way. Now, as far as some of the milestones were concerned, the very first launch, of course, was a truly major milestone. And it worked, even though the plan for Vela, the early plan, had been to have 5 launches just to get one successful launch. It was viewed as purely an R&D program to learn how to do the problem of monitoring for nuclear explosions in space, and it was structured that way. Well, when the first launch was a success and most of the instruments worked, in fact, a very high percentage of everything worked beautifully, there was an immediate wondering about what to do, and the program was stretched out a little bit and said, let's continue since we have all of the hardware in the pipeline and it's already approved, let's go forward, but we'll take a little more time in between launches. So for the first 3 launches, it continued really as an R&D program. And by then, we knew quite a bit of information. The program, not suddenly, but more gradually, became oriented more toward an operational program. And after the 3rd launch, it was decided to expand the scope of the satellite, expand the size, do more measurements of various kinds on the Vela satellites. And that's the phase 2 that you may have heard, bigger satellites and heavier satellites. That was a milestone of sorts. And the late 60s, there was perception that the Vela program was ending, and now what do we do? And a lot of concern was developed over that. But finally, it was decided to merge the mission into another satellite program with another mission, and that has to remain undefined right now because it's a classified program, and the missions are classified. The fact that we have a continuing verification mission is not classified, but the way we do it is classified. And the first decision was made by the Air Force that they were going to do that entirely themselves with contractors. They had worked with the AEC at that time and the AEC laboratories, Los Alamos and Sandia, and not been able to control them in a way they can control contractors, and they were very frustrated with that, frankly. So they tried this. They started off doing it, and it didn't work out very well. First of all, they called Sandia back in to help with downward-looking detector systems for the atmosphere. That had been a division of labor from very early on, that Los Alamos would look into space and Sandia would look in the atmosphere for nuclear explosions. Their contractor wasn't doing very well there, and they called Sandia back in. And then for phase 2 of this program, there was an agreement that Los Alamos would resume its role in providing instrumentation to look in space as well.
Can you name a few people at Sandia who would be primary targets for us?
Yes, I believe I can. A man who's now retired, but who was very much of a mover in those days, equivalent to Dick Toshek at our place, is a man named Jim Scott. And I think he still lives in Sandia, and he's a relatively young man still, so he probably is still around. But he retired from Sandia. Okay, some other people would be Bill Meyer, M-Y-R-E, and a man who, and he's still there, although he's not working in this program anymore. But finally, another person who is still working in this program is Herbert Dumas. Herbert M. Dumas, D-U-M-A-S, Jr. And he's a department head now, concerned with the satellite programs.
Okay. We really have to run, but let me just ask one, I can't stop, I'm sorry, but during this period, let's say, could you provide a very quick yes or no contrast? Was there a contrast in the style of research, in pressures on you, in the general atmosphere of doing research in your old group, in the old Cockcroft-Walton group, as opposed to the new space group? Were you able to concentrate in any different way? Was there a change in research atmosphere?
Yeah, there was quite a change in the sense that what we had been doing before was an ongoing, panic mode operation. It was just the typical kind of research that would be carried on, I think, in a university without, mm-hmm. for the most part, without very urgent schedules. Mm-hmm. The picture changed totally when we got into the space activity, and in fact, it wasn't even research. It was like making a new machine or something mm-hmm. like that. It was engineering and testing and just all kinds of things of that sort. And unfortunately, it remained so even after data began coming in. It was a great frustration by us and by others that not enough attention could be given to data that we were getting in the early years. Now, that's changed now. We publish a tremendous amount.
Was it worth it?
Oh, you bet it was worth it. Most fun I've ever had.
Great.
Okay. Well,
we'll just break it off now, but this is only an exploratory, and we'll certainly get back to you.
Very good.
Thank you.